Good evening and welcome to this week's edition of the Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm your host, Ryan Coogan. My guest tonight is Julie Klinger, Associate Professor of Geography and Spatial Sciences at the University of Delaware. Professor Klinger is a leading expert in critical mineral geopolitics, particularly focusing on rare earth elements and their extraction, use, and social environmental impacts across global supply chains. She is also the author of the book Rare Earth Frontiers, From Terrestrial Subsoils to Lunar Landscapes. Thanks for joining us, Professor Klinger.
I'm delighted to be here.
So to begin with, what are rare earth elements and what makes them special?
Well, the first thing we need to know about rare earth elements is that they are not actually rare. I dug into the history of this name, and the first reference that I could find of chemists decrying this misnomer is actually from 1907.
Wow.
Right. But I think they're called rare earth elements because it's much catchier and honestly, I think quite a bit more exciting than actually referring to these 17 chemically similar elements by name. Right, they have names like praseodymium, neodymium, samarium, gadolinium, terbium, dysprosium, and so on. But the thing that makes them special is, you know, they're used in an array of technologies because they have these fantastic magnetic and conductive properties. So they're used, for example, in super high-powered magnets, in wind turbines, electric vehicles, and defense technology. They're used as catalysts in petroleum refining. They're used in lighting. They're used in rechargeable batteries and fiber optic cables. And some of them even have lovely color properties, right? So if you or your relatives have any lovely pink glassware or rose-colored glasses around the house, chances are that is cerium, another rare earth element. That's used to impart that lovely pink color.
And so, yeah, we often talk about rare earth elements when we discuss the green energy technology, such as wind turbines and electric vehicles, as you mentioned. Could you explain why exactly these elements are so critical to the green energy transition?
That's a really good question. And they have gotten a lot more press in recent years because of very real concerns around the unsustainable mining practices that are involved in producing rare earth elements. And it seems a bit of a contradiction that renewable energy should be premised on destructive mining practices. Now, rare earth elements are among a whole set of elements that are foundational to low carbon technologies. But it does bear mentioning that rare earths are critical to any form of energy generation, including fossil fuel energy generation. But some examples of renewable energy are neodymium and dysprosium. They're essential for permanent magnets, and these are used in offshore wind turbines and electric vehicle motors. Lanthanum and cerium are used in batteries and fuel cells. And, well, I mean, there's a number of different demand projections out there, right, assuming we make progress toward our renewable energy goals. But the International Energy Agency, for example, they are predicting that demand for rare earths for clean energy technologies could increase 4 to 7-fold by 2040, right, under net zero scenarios.
Wow. So rare earth mining is often associated with significant environmental problems, as you mentioned. What are the key environmental costs incurred by rare earth mining, and in which parts of the extraction process does the pollution occur?
Yeah, so the interesting thing about rare earth elements is that they're complicated kind of from the get-go, right? Because the geological conditions under which a mineable deposit of rare earth elements are likely to coalesce also happen to be the same geological conditions under which, say, radioactive material might coalesce in mineable deposits. So many rare earth ores do contain thorium or uranium, which means that when you're digging the stuff up, looking for the rare earths, you're generating thorium or uranium as byproducts. So that's at the mining site. And then because we're talking about 17 chemically similar elements, that means they're bonded together really tightly with each other, as well as, of course, with their parent material. And so that means it takes a lot of energy, a lot of chemicals to separate them one from another. Some of the techniques that have historically been used are acid leaching and solvent extraction. And these chemical processes can generate a toxic sludge and contaminate water if they're not managed properly. And then at every step of the supply chain, right, or the early stages of the supply chain, typically the proportion of the waste that is generated is so much bigger than, you know, the stuff that we actually want. And so this creates a pretty massive waste footprint that has historically proven challenging to manage simply because of the magnitude of it, right? We're talking about dust, we're talking about runoff, we're talking about tailings and water contamination.
Right. And so you mentioned that rare earths are not, in fact, rare at all. Could you talk about the use of the term rare and how it perpetuates scarcity myths surrounding these elements and influences how and where they are mined and who bears the environmental costs of this mining?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I've spent a lot of time really thinking about this because, you know, if you look at the way that rare earth elements are talked about, especially in policy and in a lot of media, you know, they're talked about in terms of, well, they're, of course, they're crucial for just about every kind of technological application we can think of. Their value-added processing is concentrated primarily in China. And so that means that the global supply, you know, is vulnerable to disruption for whatever reason, right, whether geopolitical or otherwise. And the thing is, that's not unique to rare earth elements. There's lots of other elements whose production or refining is concentrated in China that are also crucial to our contemporary technologies, things like cobalt and vanadium. So I think, honestly, this is the best theory that I've been able to come to. I think the term rare sticks around because it's exciting, right? And if you think about this, right, think about the recent policy pronouncements, the memos from the White House, the eye-catching headlines. If something is called rare, it excites a sense of like, wow, this thing is precious. It must be, you know, highly coveted or sought after and great lengths. People have to go to great lengths in order to get this very precious thing that we all need. That's quite different from, say, having a word like praseodymium in a headline, right, which doesn't have any connotations of rareness or the related excitement.
Right. And so given this pollution, you know, and their lack of, you know, the fact that they're not exactly rare, what are some of the biggest opportunities available for procuring rare earth elements in a more sustainable manner?
You know, I think the key thing comes down to investment, because although, you know, the geology of rare earths presents its challenges, right? The separations presents its challenges. You know, extractive industries have invested a lot in increasing the efficiency of their processes and reducing the overall waste footprint and all of that, particularly in contexts where the law requires them to do that. And so, my best assessment of the situation is that the social and environmental hazards that are associated with rare earth mining are not because the technology and the know-how to do things better doesn't exist. It's that it's not applied and it's not enforced. And so the first opportunity there is honestly, I think, low-hanging fruit, right? Regulate, but then also incentivize best practices as well. That's one. The other has to do with, I think, a larger question around around the energy transition and efficiency and climate change goals more generally, which is we really do have to look at the global geography of our supply chains. And there's been a long-standing call, I mean, really for decades, on environmental justice grounds alone, for major consuming economies to take more of a responsibility for producing the materials that they and we need. And so there has been a lot of movement in the rare earth sector in particular to reshore or quote-unquote friendshore and diversify the rare earth supply chain, in part to move away from real or perceived geopolitical vulnerabilities with respect to China. But also, you know, this does align with China's own domestic interests to reduce its share of overall rare earth mining and processing in order to address its domestic environmental problems as well.
So speaking of investment, just today it was announced that the U.S.-based rare earth producer MP Materials has struck a $400 million direct investment deal with the Pentagon to build a 10,000 metric ton magnet manufacturing facility. This will make the Pentagon the company's largest shareholder. Could you talk about the significance of this announcement?
Yeah, this is a really incredible announcement for a couple of different reasons. One, it also, in addition to the aspects of the deal that you described, it also includes a 10-year purchasing agreement and sets a minimum price for rare earth magnets, in addition to providing loans and other forms of support. And so this is the kind of long-term industrial planning and price guarantees that for years, I mean, I've been studying these materials for 15 years, et cetera, and involved in policy dialogues around diversifying the global supply chain for about as long. And for the longest time, proposals such as a long-term purchasing agreement, a minimum price guarantee so that companies can make a go of it, those were considered just impossible, right? Under like a World Trade Organization, economic globalization, free market framework, you just don't do those kinds of things. And this deal is even, controversial in Washington, including among historically conservative institutions like the Cato Institute, et cetera. They're critiquing this as a handout, that it's anathema to the principles of a competitive free market economy, and it's fundamentally hostile to economic growth because it is not forcing these companies to compete. But on the other hand, when we are talking about sectors that are as critical to society as the rare earth sector and all of its diverse technological applications, and as complex as rare earth elements, in order to actually build a robust supply chain, it does require long-term planning, some sort of price assurance or guarantee, and substantial investment. I mean, if anything, this is taking a minor page out of China's own playbook for consolidating and building its domestic rare earth industry several decades ago.
Right. Yeah, so you mentioned China. It's pretty much impossible to talk about rare earth elements today without discussing China. They mine about 60% of the world's total supply. So how did China come to dominate the rare earth mineral market? Is it because there's a large number of deposits in the country, or are there other economic and political factors at play?
Oh, yeah. Well, I would say the story has much more to do with the economic and political factors than strictly geology. Because rare earth elements are not that rare, they're found relatively ubiquitously all over the Earth's crust. And so if you're a country with a larger territory like China or Russia or Canada or the United States, you're just going to have more rare earth elements relative to smaller countries. But the thing that really explains China's rise, well, I guess there's two factors. The first is that pretty much from the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949, rare earth industry development was a cornerstone of national development because of its very close links to weaponry and heavy industry. Developing a rare earth industrial base was a centerpiece of cooperation between China and the former Soviet Union before, the two heads of state had a falling out later in the 50s. And there was pretty substantial knowledge transfer between the former Soviet Union and China in the early 1950s. And then there was really a lot of work going in very early on to build the industrial infrastructure and foster the knowledge development to work with these elements. And then fast forward to the 1980s, right? During all this time, from the 1950s to the 1980s, the Mountain Pass mine in Southern California was one of the primary sources of rare earth elements globally. But then Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, among many of the things that they did, one of the things that they did was to make it much easier for industries located in the West to leave, to go overseas, right? They eliminated capital controls and all of this. And that happened right around the same time that new leadership in China, Deng Xiaoping, decided to selectively open the Chinese economy to welcome foreign direct investment, particularly in strategic sectors like the rare earth sector. So essentially, you had firms using state-of-the-art technology in the West looking to go elsewhere with lower environmental regulations and lower labor costs, and you had China laying out the welcome mat. And so you put these two things together and then, you know, move forward a couple more decades to the turn of the millennium, and all of a sudden, China produces 97% of rare earth elements, and the Mountain Pass facility has gone bankrupt.
Hmm. Yeah, and so, you know, when many of the mines in China were opened in the 50s, as you mentioned, waste management and environmental protection weren't major priorities. How has the attitude towards the impact of rare earth mining changed in China in recent years, and how are they dealing with the industry's pollution problems?
It's interesting. I mean, it's a definite. If you take a national level perspective, it's definitely uneven, right? There are some cases where, you know, cleanup is they're like the poster child for environmental remediation and cleanup. I've reviewed some of these scientific papers that show, you know, a formerly devastated landscape now covered in vegetation. And then in other places, you know, mining has really continued to expand. You know, the move from this kind of ideology of develop first and clean up later, like moving from the develop part to the cleanup part, was really driven by domestic environmental activism across multiple sectors of society. So, of course, villages and people who are living with the effects of pollution mobilized, protested, did all sorts of things. Scientists, environmental scientists, soil scientists, water scientists, epidemiologists within China were documenting the impacts of pollution on local communities. And a host of policymakers, right, including in what used to be known as the Ministry of Environmental Protection, you know, we're very carefully documenting and even issuing fines. And one of the interesting kind of anecdotes that I heard in my field work there about a decade ago was from a local environmental official in the rare earth capital of the world, which is Bayan Obo in Inner Mongolia, China. And he described the kind of pivot from develop first, clean up later to let's clean up now as the pivot in whether or not their fines were paid, right? So what I mean is, you know, they would say a company would be discharging waste into a water body or not using proper pollution control measures, and the ministry would issue a fine and it would never be paid. And then one day, companies started paying their fines. That's very interesting, right? So the other part of this, too, though, is that, you know, China has really looked to move itself up the value-added ladder of production. So they haven't wanted to be primarily a miner. They've wanted to focus instead on value-added production. And so that means that they're importing stuff that's mined elsewhere into China and processing it there. And that also means then that companies that had been operating in China, primarily mining this stuff, are going elsewhere. So in a sense, that story that I told you about companies leaving the West to go in search of lower environmental regulations and cheaper labor costs, right, that explains the move from the West to China. Now a similar process is happening as firms have left China and gone to places in Central Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, and Southeast Asia to mine rare earth elements and then ship them to China for processing.
Hmm. And so how is this shift from a more extraction-focused rare earth element mining into value-added processing? You know, how is this expanding China's both soft and economic power throughout the world in regions where they're moving these extraction step to?
Yeah, this is a really interesting and complex story, right? So the story that we most frequently hear in English language media is, you know, there's words like China has a chokehold or a stranglehold on the rare earth supply chain, and it's overwhelmingly talked about in terms of, you know, China's dominance and the Western vulnerability as a result. And there's certainly some truth to that, I think, as recent events have shown. But that narrative completely overlooks the fact that what is now being talked about as a problem for the longest time was a business solution. Send your stuff to China. China is a reliable trade partner, right? You know, everyone from advanced aerospace companies to novelty toy making companies located in North America were perfectly happy to source their stuff from China, and many, in fact, continue to do so because these business relationships are well established. But in other parts of the world, right, for example, in parts of Central Asia where and parts of Sub-Saharan Africa, where Chinese companies have either set up shop or have provided investment, you know, that investment or those companies by some segments of society are welcomed as bringing jobs and development. And still other parts of the world, for example, in Myanmar, which is just over the border with China in the southwest, it's a very different story, right, where you have a kind of unholy alliance between smaller scale Chinese companies and traders and mines that are controlled by the military junta that currently controls Myanmar. And there's all sorts of terrible stories about people being violently removed from their land, about widespread pollution of soil and water, and that material is trucked over the border for processing in China. So it's a complex global landscape, right? One more aspect that I want to add just to kind of round out the story. So when a facility in the West wants to set up a state-of-the-art rare earth separations facility, they have to get, ideally, they get the most advanced expertise, consulting, and technology. And because China has been investing in this area for decades, that expertise comes from China. And so this is the case with respect to the Australian company Lynas, right? Chinese engineers and consultants were really important for helping them set up their separation facility. This was also the aspiration for some hopeful companies in the United States, which unfortunately those relationships kind of got caught up in the crosshairs of the U.S.-China trade disputes. So you see how there's like a lot of different things going on here. And of course it's controversial, but it's not universally controversial for everyone.
Right. And so to kind of take a big picture look, in an ideal world, what's your vision for how enough of these materials can be produced at scale while still avoiding the negative consequences of extraction and processing?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a couple of different options, right? There's no single fix, but three principles I would say are essential. The first would be seriously invest in a circular economy, right? We have to be asking ourselves why, given that the value-added processing is concentrated in China, why is it that there's still so much of a push to open new mines elsewhere? I mean, we could open 100 new mines and all that material is still going to be shipped to China for processing, right? So that doesn't really solve the problem. Whereas instead, if we really seriously invest in building circular economy infrastructure and prioritize recycling and reuse of rare earth elements from electronics, from wind turbines, from EVs, from decommissioned infrastructure, that's really like there's nowhere to go but up, right, if we follow that strategy, because today less than 1% of rare earths are recycled. Right. So 99% are being thrown away. And we can change that with, I think, some policy and logistical tweaks. I think the second principle would be really thinking carefully about geographically distributed processing. So the situation that we're in right now, where, you know, multiple political blocs, including China, but also the EU, the US, Russia, are racing to set up their own kind of insular supply chains, right? What this is doing basically is it's unleashing a new scramble for rare earth elements. And with that kind of competitiveness, you have hoarding, which leads to scarcity, and which also leads to production that isn't actually tied to actual need. And so by contrast, a more cooperative international approach, which hopefully we'll get to someday, could have regionally coordinated supply networks, right, where you could still have some degree of specialization, but also some degree of redundancy and duplication, so that, you know, when folks need these materials, they have multiple options to get them. And I think the third piece, and this applies really to extractive industries more generally, but there's a lot of opportunity in the rare earth sector, is to really focus on community-centered governance, right? The industry, unfortunately, has been characterized by, historically, you know, by running roughshod over local rights and environments and expropriating people of their lands and all of this. And so, you know, there is a way to do mining that doesn't involve violating environmental protection laws or violating labor rights, right? So there are opportunities here, but it does involve actually investing in, incentivizing, and enforcing the implementation of best practices.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show, Professor Klinger. Before we wrap up, where can our listeners find your work and learn more about this topic?
Oh, excellent. I'm so glad you asked. So actually, the book that you mentioned at the very beginning, that is available for free. It's an open access ebook, so doing a little bit of an internet search should connect you with it. And then there are a number of talks that I think are available on YouTube and various podcast platforms.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming on.
All right. Thank you. Have a great night.
You've been listening to the Perpetual Notion Machine on listener-supported community radio. My guest tonight was Professor Julie Klinger. Thanks for listening.